Welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, it's a huge one, folks. This is the long-lost Lance Bangs episode. Lance Bangs, of course, is well known for his directing, his work with the visuals in all sorts of bands. It's an incredible episode, not because of me at all, but more on that in a second. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to DamienAbraham.com. There's an email address there that you can hit me up at. You can also find me on various forms of social media at Left for Damien, LeftForDamian. You can also go over to Facebook.com and you can like the Turned Out of Punk Facebook page. It's run by my brother, Tristan Abraham. He'll get the message to me. Whatever you want me to know, you let him know. And he'll let me know. We also post stuff up on there that gets sent into the show from various listeners and things like that. So worth the follow, or worth the like, I should say, if you use Facebook. If you don't use Facebook, you can go over to Tumblr.com, and we post all that same stuff on the turnedoutofpunk.tumblr.com page. And I guess that's about it for ways that you can get in touch with us. But if you want to support this show, you can go over to iTunes and you can subscribe to this thing. You can write a review. You can rate it. If you don't use iTunes, you can tell all your friends about it. But if you do use iTunes, you will notice that we have a couple other podcasts in this little podcast family. There's, of course, Turned Out of Punk. There is Turned Out of Punk Footnotes, which is run by myself and Chris O'Toole, where each week we dissect a Turned Out of Punk episode and get kind of into all the kind of nerdy, great stuff that gets brought up that we just gloss over on this show. Don't worry, on Footnotes, Chris O'Toole and myself, we dissect it. There is also Clobbering Time, which is Tom Bryan, an editor over at StereoGum.com, and myself. And each week we talk about pro wrestling. We have a lot of guests from the world of music. We've had some great guests so far. We're going to have great guests in the future. So check out that podcast. There's also Oil and Flowers, which is myself and DJ Buddha Blaze talking about cannabis. Talking about cannabis with guests. That is coming soon. So you'll find all that in the feed for now. They'll have their own feeds eventually. So don't freak out if you don't like those podcasts. Don't have to listen to them. Just keep listening to Turned Out of Punk. And yeah, that's it, I think, for now. On to today's show. So I'm recording this right now in the bathroom of a hotel room, but I only tell you that to explain why I'm trying to keep my voice is somewhat quiet right now, because I don't want to get thrown out of the hotel, which is a genuine fear that you have this late at night when you're talking to yourself at a louder than normal volume. But also, I wanted to get to the fact that this is the Lost Lance Bangs episode. Now, for those of you who don't know him, you are certainly familiar with stuff he's worked on or his work, maybe without even knowing it. He's done stuff with Jackass, with Odd Future, with Nirvana, with REM, with Mercury Rev, with there's so much. He is one of these people that has been in every almost important place in pop culture that you can be in. He is one of those rare people that's just there, you know? Like, this is one of those great episodes because of that. Now, here's why it is not such a great episode. First of all, this is probably the worst interview I've ever done on this show. I had stayed up all night the night before recording the interview with Steve McDonald. If you want to go back, you can listen to that episode. And so I was exhausted. And I was in New York for Vice 20, a big party that they had put together. We were putting this band together with John Joseph. We talk about this in some previous episodes, so go back and listen to those ones if you are want to hear more of this story, because I assure you, it's worth it. I think we talked about it on the Steve McDonald one. Anyway, so I was exhausted, and I decided that the best way to kind of get ready for this Lance Bangs interview, which I had early that next morning, was by drinking a ton of coffee. And I don't drink coffee. So when you listen to this, you will hear a decidedly different Damien than you hear normally. I am very excited, and so I have to, first of all, apologize to Lance for that, because I cut him off a lot. And I jump on what he's saying a lot. But in spite of that, this is still an amazing conversation, because Lance is so open And Lance is so awesome. And he really, you know, talks about some incredibly personal parts of his life and, you know, lets, you know, me into that. And, you know, this is in spite of the fact that I'm jumping over everything he's saying because I am flying on caffeine a million miles a minute. So I apologize to Lance for that. Also, I apologize to him because, once again, I apologize to him as I apologize to him on this podcast, and I've apologized to him about this numerous times since then. But I had a blank spot in my memory of meeting him. And this is from me, who's a huge fan of his. And I have a bunch of these weird blank spots in my memory all around the time that I was using certain anti-anxiety medications. And I'm not talking about the natural one that I use now, weed. I'm talking about a certain pharmaceutical one that I was using. And I have these weird moments in my mind that I don't remember any of the details of. And hanging out with Lance Bangs the first time is one of these experiences. And now I don't want to say it's because of the medication, because let's be honest, I've also made a bit of a career out of smashing cans and microphones into my head. And so I know I've also taken a few hits to the head over the years as well. But you know, it is something that I think about and I worry about. And, you know, it's something I'm a little self-conscious about, that there are these moments that I just don't remember, you know, and here I'm meeting someone that I'm a huge fan of, that's a massive, massively influential and, you know, inspirational person to me. And I don't even remember the first time I met him. You know, it's just this weird black spot in my mind. And, you know, same with the first time I met Nardwar. I don't remember that at all either. You know, I remember the second time I met Nardwar, thankfully, but not the first time. So all of this kind of added up to me being incredibly self-conscious about this episode and about putting it out there. So I ran into Lance when we were at Riot Fest, and he and I were hanging out, and I brought up this episode, and he was like, you should put it out. I've decided to put it out. So, like, I got over myself because it's worth hearing for everyone else, because there's some awesome stuff in this episode. And as I say, Lance will be back for a part two. This was just the beginning. And he is someone, yeah, if you, you know, go and check some of the stuff he's worked on. I'm sure you already are very familiar with a lot of the stuff he worked on. And, you know, just bask in the glory of the fact that here's this one person, you know, who's in so many kind of key moments in, I don't know, the musical universe, the pop culture universe that I find fascinating. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy one of the very first Turned Out of Punk episodes that I ever did, way back when, in the heady days of December 2014, Lance Bangs on Turned Out of Punk. Okay. Lance, thank you so much for coming, or well, me coming to you, I guess, and, yeah. And having, this is awesome. Like, I really, you're someone that I wanted to interview, and I guess we never met until this trip, but I saw you at that Odd Future in-store in Toronto.
I filmed Fucked Up in 2007 or 2008 when you were playing at South By.
Did we meet, though?
Oh, yeah. You were wearing like a...
South By is like the weirdest,
yeah,
weirdest mash of no sleep and energy drinks for me. So I apologize, but
you might have been wearing like a UGK shirt.
Yeah, the giant UGK shirt. Yeah. I have like very little memories of that. That was back when I was on anti-anxiety pills, so I have huge gaps. So I apologize for that.
No, we ran out of Austin for a little bit during that time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Holy shit, that's totally so weird. Because then when I saw you with, I'm like, oh shit, that's Lance Bangs, completely blanking out that I had met you in Austin. Then.
Yeah.
Well, then, do we have a good time?
We had a great time.
Oh, well, that's good to hear.
Yeah. A lot of talk about Bun B.
No.
We saw a good Deer Hunter show.
MJ played the first Jay Reutard show, or the second Jay Reutard show, I guess, he had ever done in that little room. I have very weird little recollections of that day.
Yeah, I was shooting a bunch of film with Jay at that time. Right. I'd been sort of in contact with him from like 2006 or 2005, 2006. I was filming a bunch of documentary footage with him and then shot the live stuff he was doing at that time.
That's great. Well, okay, but before we get to all that, I guess we should start at the very beginning and the way we start them all, how did you get into punk?
I feel like I got into it. I was in a military family that moved around quite a bit, mm-hmm. and I would guess that when I was like starting to read, I was born in 1972, kind of at the end of the year. So at the time of like 77, 78, 79, 80, when things were popping up in, like, at least we might have been like in Willingboro, New Jersey, sort of on the East Coast at that time, you would see things on like, you know, TV transmissions out of New York or Philadelphia where Fear would turn up on Saturday Night Live, or there'd be an episode of Quincy with Punks, there would be, you know, these little pockets of things turning up, or just as like weird local color profiles on local news, there'd be, you know, look at the splendid pageantry of the kids lining up outside to see the Buzzcocks, a band that's named, can we say that on the air, you know, that sort of thing was going on, and Patti Smith was, you know, popping up on talk shows and appearances, and had this really great song that she did, I think on like, I don't know if it was a Today Show or Mike Douglas, she did her poem that's like, you know, she had just, like, fallen off a stage and had the neck brace on and was like, you know, I was working really hard to show the world what I could do. And it just, like, as a child, it, like, clicked. It's like, here's this woman that looks like the sort of archetypical Keith Richards rock and roll, you know, that aesthetic, but is, like, doing something that's, like, clear and refined and poetic and yet is, like, working in a sing-songy way for a five-year-old's brain to, like, process and be like, oh, this is, like, much more charismatic than the woman that's teaching me in kindergarten, but like these words are delivered in a similar way. But this is like exciting.
That's awesome that resonated at such a young age.
Yeah,
too.
Like that just stuck with me. You know. Yeah. So I started actively seeking things like that out. So there was, you know, used bookstores or newsstands at the time where you could kind of plow through whatever the normal People magazine stuff was. Yeah. There was also
Cream.
Weird pockets of like punk kind of influencing writers at places that, you know, they weren't necessarily like. Because there's a stigma at the time. It looked like clownery. Like, it looked like, you know, the sort of the safety pin, you know, spiked hair, bad hair dye look was something that felt like goofballs or people that were like, look at me, or kind of zany people.
And there was that period of, like, almost like, punksploitation.
Yeah.
Like overload. Where you have, like, like the Quincy Punks episode.
People who liked the feeling or the regurgitation of culture and everything getting smashed. Like, people that were writing at maybe like a humor magazine and took that aesthetic and would start writing weirder stuff. Like Marvel magazine, Marvel, the comic book thing, they had like a cheap knockoff of Mad magazine at the time called Crazy that I don't think anyone is bothering to, you know, there's like Cracked and Crazy and Mad.
I was a huge Mad fan.
Yeah.
I collected like the comic book editions and all that.
So they would handle punk a little bit, but then this, it felt like the writing staff, the writing staff of this like one weird Marvel thing, Crazy, that no one was buying, just like went dark and fucked up and like, like shifted their mascot to this like fucked up, like disgusting character, Obnoxio the Clown, and started like covering like all the dark films that were coming out at the time, like Taking the Pelham 123 or
Taxi Driver,
like really like going deep into that vein and like doing kids parodies of those kind of things or Escape from New York or whatever.
Yeah.
And so you could tell that the people there writing were, you know, were probably like in New York City and taking drugs and disillusioned and hanging out with Lester Bangs. And
well, that's what, like, I guess would punk have been in?
Punk would have already been, for sure. So I'm sure that's where they wanted to be.
Doing that kind of vibe.
So that kind of overlap with just people that were probably in New York and hanging out at, you know, Max's or CBGB's or whatever at the time and, like, had some shitty writing staff job. But we're going to do what they could with it.
So were you just picking this up as, like...
Like, the weird things you had spotted at a newsstand or used bookstore or whatever that, like...
I'm just kind of piecing it
stood out or pieced out. Or, like, you know... And it was also, like, sort of, I would say by 80, like, Debbie Harry was on season 5 of The Muppet Show. And, like, that was maybe the first... like physical attraction to somebody, like seeing something that was like, whoa, like this, what's happening here? This is exciting. Like, why am I feeling this way? That, she kind of like cut through and then you would see her doing, you know, just like performing on, again, like late night TV shows or whatever as a kid.
Yeah. I guess at that point it was kind of crossing over to the new wave.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So at what point were you, do you think you went to your first show? Do you remember?
Oh, man.
Or actually, maybe before that, did you buy a record? Like, what did you remember?
Yeah. Like I picked up stuff, at the time. Like, I think there was some confusion, the sort of the leather jacket look that the Ramones are pulling off. And then Fonzie also on TV, but like clearly was like, wait, that's not the same thing, you know, but then, associating that with punk, I think I might've had a babysitter give me a copy of The Game by the band Queen, which looked like maybe like that leather look, but then it was like, wait, this is a super processed, but like kind of dark and fun record, like this kind of, you know, Don't Try to Suicide.
Awesome.
Yeah, and like I loved Another One Bites the Dust at that time. I loved Under Pressure.
Yeah.
But like clearly it was like, okay, they're mining that look. I mean, a different version of the sort of the biker look, but realizing that there's all these different things that were coming out at that time that were using leather jackets that were variations of like Rebellion.
Yeah. I guess it was like the symbol. I remember there's like the Warner Brothers Bugs Bunny ad with the button in the leather jacket when they started when they acquired Sire.
Sire Records, yeah.
And everything like that. So
I don't know. I think that like that was like a mistaken attempt at buying something that I thought looked like it might be.
Well, that's punk, when you're that age, you're still like figuring out the signpost. Like you're like, oh, this is
what the indicators are.
Punk.
Yeah.
And this is punk and everything.
So it might have been more like a straight up like Patti Smith or Sex Pistols record that like really, you know, caught through and counted. And you know, the Clash was on the radio. Things were available, at least like in the Northeast. Like
Did you actually like, this is like a weird question that I always kind of bring up, but did you ever, you know, were you a Clash or a Sex Pistols fan?
Like, I have to say, like, I like the energy of the Sex Pistols more. There's catchier stuff going on with some of the Clash, but they felt cokey by the time that I was like really listening to it. You could tell that they were like indulgent, coked out dudes to some extent. Like it felt like they were, you would see them in the stuff where it's like, to them it's exciting or ironic to be like riding around in a big American car convertible, but it felt like, oh, these are like, they're wearing sunglasses and like being comfortable and...
Well, the Sex Pistols, I guess, were that perfectly preserved slice of time.
Yeah.
Like I'm the same way. Never mind the Bollocks is like, you know, like the Clash, like I'm not throwing the baby the bathwater on them, but like, yeah, it's just like, I don't know, something about the Sex Pistols that was like a confluence of time and space that brought everything there. And
I've had a great time listening to the Clash over the years. There's great moments in my life associated with them. But like, there really was this sort of like, I had this anti-indulgence thing where anyone that felt like they were in that like weird, coked out, self-congratulatory mode was not what I was connecting with or identifying with.
So at which point would you say when you went to your first, like, well, I guess even like concert or show?
There's a couple things. I think it was called the Fresh Fest. I ended up like, because we're in a military family, moving around quite a bit and was in Montgomery, Alabama by the mid 80s.
Were you encountering other people on the bases that were in a punk?
Like, yeah, you know, weirdly enough, I have to say like there were pockets of that because you're being uprooted a lot. Maybe there's a sense of disassociation with what's going on around you and looking for things that speak to that. And there's I have to say, like, within military culture, there are people that sort of, because you are in such a uniform look and, you know, people do try and distinguish themselves or have a little thing that's their thing. Yeah. You know, so there's the guy that's, like, really into rap in 81, you know, like, already that's his thing. And, you know, that's the guy that likes that stuff. And so these post-exchanges where they, I think that, like, the prices of things are really kept low so that, A, people can afford it on the sort of, I mean, currently, like, the salary for a... Some in the army the first year or two is like $18,500. You know, it's an incredibly low pay lifestyle. That they keep the cost of these things low, and there's no sales tax on them when you buy them on the base. So you could get cassettes of Sandinista for like $4. You know, like it was this entirely affordable thing to like entertain yourself by, like, oh, and you know, that's on CBS Columbia Records at the time. It's totally available. Yeah, and you're reading, you know, the press is writing about it. If you pick up a Rolling Stone magazine and they're saying what the good records are, they're saying Sandinista, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not really that hard for, you know, it was out there in the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I was, you know, sort of exposed to stuff, and there were 85, I would guess it was probably like in Montgomery, Alabama, there's this thing called the Fresh Fest, which was Fat Boys, Run DMC, Dougie Fresh, like all these
was it package records?
Tour. No, it was like people that were offshoots of, you know, Rush Management in New York at that time, kind of put together this package deal where they're capitalizing on the momentum of Run DMC and putting together like other New York acts to go out and do shows. And so just from being around people on the base and like other kids, you know, certainly like most white culture in Alabama at the time hadn't caught on to it, but it was like, you had friends that were like, and I love the Fat Boys. Like, I think they're one of the great underrated hip hop duos. Like, when they were just the Disco Three and just like performing what they wanted to perform, they were impeccable MCs. Okay. And then they got talked into doing that ridiculous, like, let's make a novelty act out of you and make all the songs about food.
But I think that's probably just because, like, well, you know, at that point, like, you look at all the hip hop artists, and I guess with the exception of, well, even Run DMC, it was like, everyone's like, all right, what's the gimmick we're going to stick on this band? Like, Run DMC, it's like leather, like the leather suits. But I guess they probably chose to wear too, but it became like, you know, the thing. And
so Disco 3 was great. Those are great MCs. They got repackaged as Fat Boys. And they're great in that context,
too. And I saw Disorderlies in the theater and loved
it.
Loved
it. So they were in, like, in movies and stuff.
Yeah.
So they did a great performance at the Montgomery Civic Center that I went to that was, like, the first live show, and I had to, like, you know, sneak out of the house to go to a kind of thing, but it was great. And then shortly thereafter, I went, like, officially, like, with, you know, people, parents knowing that I was going to see Hall & Oates with the opening act was English Beat.
Oh, wow.
And that was, so yeah, that they might have been the first thing I saw. That was fun. But there weren't a whole lot of options of, like, punk things going on in Montgomery in 1985.
Yeah, I can't even think of, you know, Alabama hardcore bands from that era, yeah, even. And so I guess you're, like, kind of, yeah, restricted to what you have access to on that base and, yeah, and things like, and who's your people around you.
Yeah. But there were, you know, again, there were bookstores, there was, like, mm-hmm, places to go hear music at record stores. And,
mm-hmm, and I guess at that point also there's the indie network has established itself, so there is distribution chains for,
like, I think it's getting established at that time. I don't know if it's really fully, there's a chain called Turtles Records and Tapes, and they were an offshoot of a thing called Peaches. It was somewhere else, yeah, in the South. But, you know, they would have, like, U2 imports, and by 85, you know, mm-hmm, it wasn't impossible to, not that that's punk, but you know what I mean?
No, no, it's pretty, yeah, it's like they,
for Montgomery, Alabama, like, you know, way. Yeah. I couldn't find any Joy Division stuff there. It wasn't until, like, I got back to New Jersey that the imported.
Had you heard of, like, Joy Division?
I would read about them. Like, I would, you know, like, there was a good, Robert Palmer, the writer for New York Times, wrote a really nice thing about Ian after he passed away in May of 1980, and, I happened to read that in the New York Times when it ran, and it was probably, like, 8 years old or whatever, and it kind of, you're thinking about death at that time,
yeah,
a little bit,
yeah,
and
yeah,
it triggers, like, wow, like, so he, like, killed himself, like, how does that, you know?
That's so, like, and I, it's so weird to, like, think about a time where you would hear about a band,
yeah,
and not immediately, like, click, 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 oh, that's, yeah, everything about him,
yeah,
and stuff like that, so, like, When you did finally hear him, was it, like, what you had expected from this?
Not at all. Like, because the, you know, that sort of drum pattern and sound at the beginning of Unknown Pleasures.
Yeah.
It's so cold and alien and creates its own world and heavy atmosphere. But if you've been coming into it having read about them in the lineage of expecting them to sound anything like the Buzzcocks or, yeah, Sex Pistols, yeah, it's a different,
totally different beast.
Yeah. Which was great. And, you know, something I just plunged headlong into.
So when you got back to New Jersey, like, what I like, so you're 8 years old, heading into Joy Division.
And reading about Joy Division. I'm not going to, yeah.
Okay, but, like,
yeah,
but when you got, what was, like, so what age were you?
It's being? Probably not until, like, 86 that we got back up to New Jersey out of Alabama, maybe 86, 87.
So you're, like, 9 or 10?
I guess so, yeah.
That's pretty young. It's like a,
and, yeah,
an
and
early, so, adopter, to say the, yeah, least.
And there's other things that weren't straight punk that were, like, really gripping my brain. And, like, whenever in 1983, I think there's a Pink Floyd album called The Final Cut.
Mm-hmm.
And I really responded as a kid to the imagery of the wall. I was probably, like, you know, yeah, in 79 when that came out, and then maybe 80 when it was really on the radio. So that's, like, 7 or 8 years old. Just, like, you know, that, yeah, that album cover is something as a kid you,
yeah,
can
striking,
connect to striking. And, like, if you open up the gatefold and see those, like, animated drawings, it's like, whoa, like, yeah, you know, and the sort of, like, yeah, I hate school, fuck teachers, yeah, kind of, yeah, thing, it really, you know, in a simplistic way connected, but then maybe there's things on there that are taking your brain in other directions beyond what,
yeah, that was, like, before I got into punk, that was, like, the last sort of, like, record I was obsessed with,
yeah,
pre getting into Sonic Youth and
totally
from that,
yeah. So when they put out The Final Cut, I bought that, and it had a really great review by Kurt Loder and Rolling Stone magazine, probably in 83. There's a wedding that happened where, like, some family member or some uncle of mine was getting married, and, like, I was bored and kind of detached from whatever was going on at the reception, and went to the newsstand that was in the hotel lobby and, like, read that issue of Rolling Stone all the way through and saw, like, this really intense description of this, like, super nihilistic, depressed, self-indulgent Pink Floyd record where the guy was on the verge of killing himself. And again, it was like, wow, like, I've got to hear this right away. This is exciting. And, like, imagining it as, like, a follow-up to The Wall, but it's, like, one of the bravest, most fucked up, indulgent records anyone's ever done. Like, it's the most insular, The Final Cut.
And that's,
it's just Roger Waters processing, like, his father's death,
yeah,
and, you know, sort of, like, Margaret Thatcher's England and the attack on the Falkland Islands. And so the fact that they were operating at that level of being, like, you know, the hugest empire-building band that they could have possibly been, and be like, no, I'm just going to take the reins and make this record about this, was kind of shocking. And it had this holophonic sound approach where they had done this Italian guy Zuccarelli had invented ways of sort of, like, phasing things so that you had a sense of spatial distance of something like 3/4 of the way behind your left ear and 5 feet back. And so there's all these sound effects and gimmicks of, like, you know, ICBM missiles going around your head or explosions or, like, footsteps drifting from, like, you know, 3/4 in front of you to behind you. And so, like, that was also just in a weird technological way, like putting on headphones and listening on a cassette Walkman and taking that in, like, this very
trippy kind of experience.
Yeah. But not like what you would think of a normal psychedelia or...
No, no.
You know,
because
I resented all of that. And
you didn't. You weren't a fan of any of that stuff? It was
no. I hated everything about adult culture at the time, and so anything that felt like, again, like kind of 60s era, hey man, like self-comforting stuff or indulge in 80s like coked out stuff, both were so repugnant to me, mm-hmm. and I just wanted nothing to do with it. And I had had a kind of traumatic experiences with people, older people, and was trying to get away from having to be around anybody that was over.
A distrust of the elderly, yeah. or the aged. So at which point were you like, you know, going to like concerts, like, you
that
know.
Would be back, that would be up in New Jersey, sort of in the mid to late 80s. Once I got out of Alabama, there was like a network of like house shows and
really
so and hall shows and stuff like that, okay. going on. Yeah,
so were some of those bands you were checking out at the time?
I was in a couple bands at the time, and then there were other bands around, so
were in bands too,
yeah. So there, you know, coming out of like Philly, there was like Token Entry, yeah. Pagan Babies, yeah. there's a place called the Franklin YMCA that was doing like hardcore shows. So is that scene in a way to kind of like connect to hardcore stuff? It was close enough to City Gardens in Trenton, New Jersey, mm-hmm. where you could go see like all the great touring bands are coming through. And there's a, for people that don't know that venue, it was a warehouse building in Calhoun Street in Trenton, New Jersey, in a very beat up, sketchy, dangerous neighborhood. Within walking distance of it, there was a sort of like junkyard of cars. And I was already like shooting a bunch of Super 8 film and kind of documenting places I was staying when I left home during that time. And so we'd go shoot film there and then go see bands, and everybody would come through. And then, you know, this guy, Randy, that was booking everything, had a great sensibility and took chances on stuff and would put together these really great lineups. But also it was close enough to New York and Philly, but didn't compete with the press in either place, mm-hmm. that like the Ramones could come down and make whatever, however many $1,000 you get for playing a punk show at that time. Yeah. And it wouldn't step on their New York draw or be like, they're all playing all the time, or I heard all those songs already. Like, it didn't, you know, infect that. And then Sonic Youth could come down and try out all the material for Daydream Nation and not worry about writers for the Village Voice being like, oh, this one's long and indulgent. Or, you know, like, they could experiment with stuff. And, again, you were playing to, like, weirdo teenagers in New Jersey and not the New York City writers, but you were, you know, it took you like an hour and 15 minutes to get there or something.
So what were some of the bands you were playing? Like, what style at least were
like? I was probably like more like Joy Division stuff. Like, I was doing what was probably like closer to spoken vocals or spoken word, mostly stuff that had originated as like journal entries or confessional writing from stuff I was going through. But trying to not work in the normal bass guitar drums idiom of what was going on with like rock and roll. Like, this friend Tom Salmon, who was, you know, playing in hardcore bands, mm-hmm. and just like, he was a year or two older than me. And when I was leaving home, his grandparents' basement was where I could like safely crash sometimes, and he had like a 4-track recorder and just like a really great guy, super solid, like, you know, punk character at that time. And we would do like 4-track recordings. We would like steal Casio keyboard. There was like Casio sampling keyboards that were out, like the era of like what had been invented technologically at that time.
Yeah.
And there's a whole racket within the East Coast of like wall-to-wall sound and video and Silo and like all these like electronics chains were like in Crazy Eddies. It had this like super competitive vibe against each other of like undercutting pricing
of
like,
our competitors
and you know, like you can get a turntable for $19 and then just this, I don't know what was going on with like how much people were buying electronics at that time, but like enough to sustain multiple vendors like competing against each other. And then like, all right, that JVC tape deck is 4 months old. Here's the new one that does the azimuth coordinator and the dual reverse. And, you know, just this like constant arms race going on of that stuff. So you could get weird electronics equipment, and people are shifting over to CDs. So like, you know, cassette stuff was like being marked down. It was, you know, it was like a weird era where you had access to things to like record yourself, mic things, amplify them. So we were taking like weird keyboards and fucking with those, and I wanted to be able to like play guitar at the same time. We didn't want to add other people because it felt too vulnerable what we were doing with the music, that we didn't want to have like some mouth breathing drummer behind us, like, you know. So we'd like take butter knives and tape them to the keys of the keyboard chords that I figured I wanted to play, and then be able to step on those like a pedal to like make these drone chords. We were like, you know, listening to White Light, White Heat and Jesus and Mary Chain stuff. And
so is that the influence of that?
Basically, like, probably like I would say, you know, the Big Star's Third, the kind of weird spooky stuff on that, which at the time I think it might have been called Sister Lovers on the version that it was like a 78 pressing out of France on PVC records that might have been called Sister Lovers instead of Third or whatever. And so that's how we knew it. And that like the configuration on that record and the track listing is a much heavier, darker, probably heroin, I don't know, version of it that doesn't start with, like, you know, the upbeat songs or whatever. So we were into that and, you know, Velvet Underground stuff, the John Cale stuff after Velvet Underground is, like, what we were into. And then, you know, at the time, there's Jesus and Mary Chain stuff in the mid-80s that was coming out that sounded like noise, fucked up stuff that was interesting. So we were making these, you know, 4-track cassette recordings, you know, teenage poetry, journal entry, confessional writing stuff over it, and playing a little bit of guitar. He was playing guitar as well. And for percussion, I didn't want to have another person around behind us. Like, and so I almost had this like distrust, just like a lot of physical distrust about people being behind me. You know, just I've been through some really horrific stuff at that point. And so I took they had these hot air popcorn poppers at the time that you'd like put kernels in some.
Yeah.
And I would like stick a mic down into that with a lot of reverb. Like I think it's called a PZM mic. Is that right? Like the one that's like a surface mic?
I have like literally, like you saw how bad I was at setting up this stuff. You now know my technological abilities.
There's a kind of microphone that Radio Shack had, which again, like we probably like stole or whatever, that you could snake, you lay it down on a surface and it just like, it records differently than the sort of a
room mic.
Correct. And put it down inside like a hot air popcorn popper with like a huge amount of delay on it, and we just like turn that on in the background. So you just it's got like kind of hum, and like after like 45 seconds or whatever, when things heat up and it starts to like pop, you get these insane explosive sounds of like the kernels of popcorn bursting with distortion and reverb. Like so, it's just like the song is building with like the Tacony Palmyra Bridge driving over again. You know, like and then like this cacophony of like multiple exploding bursts going off, like and the audience is like completely unnerved and freaked out.
So you mentioned you'd already started filming. At this point,
yeah,
when like you know, obviously, you found got a camera,
yeah,
but, like were there film influences at that point for you? Or
no, I hadn't really seen a lot of
like super film stuff, or
not really. Yeah. It was just like it was like the only tool or format to sort of document what I was going through or where I was staying. I was like leaving home and staying in a lot of 24-hour laundromats or gas station bathrooms that I'd lock myself
like,
into.
Like, how long were you homeless? Or like,
I wouldn't say homeless, I would say like leaving and running away and then you know, going back sometimes when I needed to.
Yeah.
Basically, we had a dog that ran away from used, and I just started like biking around trying to find it. And then when something clicked, you know, at that age, like driving around, like trying to find it, like, oh, wait, like it got out.
Yeah.
Oh, like it might be better off. Like I'm better off. Like, you know, like that somehow.
So what age are you at this point? Like
I was pretty,
pretty young.
Yeah. And so from that point, I started kind of heading out at night and then started like feeling vulnerable after some things happened and started taking cameras or tape recorders with me with the idea that like I wanted before I disappeared to have some recording of what.
So that's what that was your thing. You wanted to just,
And then that just kind of kept growing and I got more comfortable having a camera in my hand or felt like a way of engaging the world or just in myself or protecting myself by having it. And then started filming things and liking what I saw at the time. You could, you know, Super 8 cartridges were really cheap or pocketable and the processing was always inexpensive. It was like, you know, $1.49 at Big B Drugs to get a roll of Super 8 processed. So it wasn't like an extravagant thing to go shoot some film and get it back and be able to like watch it on a projector in the privacy of your room.
It's weird because like I didn't go through an abuse situation, but I did have like this spell where I like was like, well, this is it. I'm going to end my life. And mine was very just like, it was like a mental health kind of breakdown situation that I was in at the time. And that's what brought it on and kind of worked through it. But it's like a real different thing to do it so young, you know?
Yeah.
And like, I can't imagine. So was it the film that kind of brought you out of it in a little?
I don't know that I really came out of it.
I don't mean to imply like, if everything's cool.
You may still be in it.
Yeah, but I mean like, was it the film that
it was definitely a way that a survival tool for sure.
Yeah, that's what I mean, got you out of the situation mentally where about ending it. Type thing.
And things remained horrible for a long time. You know, it wasn't like that solved everything.
I don't mean to imply that at all. Sorry.
But that was sort of like what my life became or how I sort of functioned in the world from that point onwards. And was it once like other cultures started popping up and there was like, you know, a band playing live or interesting kids hanging out or whatever, like, you know, filming that and trying to preserve that. Because it also felt like there was a drowning happening where there was this deluge. Like I don't know if people who didn't live through it can even imagine or not feel like I'm being hyperbolic, but like there was a suffocation happening where there were so many people within that baby boomer generation and they had so much wealth and power at the time that they were, you know, being catered to and advertised to by the media and such a lack of imagination for what could be that like, you know, I was saying earlier that there was this pocket of time where like maybe Columbia or CBS was backing the Clash or whatever, but like
then
after that, like it stopped and it was this regressive thing where like it really was just, you know, John Cougar Mellencamp and John Bon Jovi and certainly like being in New Jersey in like 87 or so, like every kid being duped into like moving around and reacting to John Bon Jovi while the Replacements were playing at City Gardens and not having anyone show up was like, what the fuck is wrong with all of you?
It's funny because you say that because, like, you know, talking to Tom Sharpling, he was like, he talked about the boss as being the oppressive force. But I guess that because he was like, he's a few years older than you. So it's like, it would have been like, I guess that was the Bon Jovi, pre-Bon Jovi kind of curse.
And you just felt like all these kids are blowing it. Like all the other 14-year-olds around you who could be making things way better for the Pixies and Nirvana and, and Sonic Youth and, you know, and Lydia Lunch, everything weird that was going on.
Yeah, like, I had
no interest in that and were just like, Cinderella, John Bon Jovi.
Were you aware of Cinema of Transgression? Because that stuff's kind of going on.
Yeah, that stuff's going on. Yeah. So there's Film Threat magazines here, like, you know, picking that up and reading about that stuff and seeing still images. But there was,
I bought a complete run of Film Threat a couple years ago.
Did you really?
Yeah, I worked at a video store, and this guy came in, and he's like, I'm selling this stuff. It was like some awesome old exploitation posters and a complete run of Film Threat, minus issue one.
Yeah.
Still.
So, you know, Nick Zedd and the Cinema Transgression, Richard Kern, all that stuff, like, it certainly was exciting or interesting on one level. Like, all the Richard Kern stuff is very, like, at that age of your life, like, compelling and sexually charged. But Nick Zedd just felt like a... There's a level of cruelty that, and a lack of imagination for seeing any beauty anywhere that, like, I did not connect with. And so I was finding more, like, poetic moments and visuals and things that I was finding in the world and trying to shoot those and excited when I would find kids that were maybe interesting rather than, like, putting a frog in a blender.
Yeah.
So that was sort of what, you know, I was maybe, like, younger and less on heroin than that crowd.
Yeah.
But I was coming up to New York at the time. Like, the other thing about being in central New Jersey or South Jersey is that you've got Philadelphia and you've got Trenton, you've got New York City within, like, the ability to, like, hop on a bus and just kind of and be there. And so it was going up and hanging out in the Lower East Side. There's a lot of great stuff going on with shows. There was Tompkins Square Park at that time was a place you could go kind of hang out.
Were you at the Breakdown Tompkins Square Park show?
No.
That's my favorite live video of all time.
I was not at that one.
Okay.
But there was, you know, there was, like, squat houses to the east of there by a couple blocks on between, like, maybe Avenue B and C or A and B, that Tom Salmon and I would go, you know, crawl up some ladders. And then, like, it was insane inside. There would just be, like, giant gaps in the floor that someone had laid down a ladder to walk over. And you had to, like, take the bravery to, like, trust that you could get over this thing to get to the next ladder up to, you know, in the dark with no electricity. But once you were up there, you'd meet a kid named Army who had left home, who had notebooks full of great writing and poetry. And, you know, there's just all this great stuff going on. And that pocket didn't feel as heroiny as other things that were, you know, it felt like kids who were just surviving and getting by and who were interesting.
So did you, you know, like this before, I guess, things were as codified as now. Did you notice the difference in the scenes going to, like, a show in Philly? I guess people would travel around for shows, too. But
because, you know, there's stuff that was, to me, kind of like... Like, the stakes were so high in my mind. Like, it felt like people were trying to not let me live.
Yeah.
You know, that I had no time for, like, goofballs at the Dead Milkman. Or, like, it felt like, what the fuck are you doing, like, joking around while people are trying to not let me live? Yeah. Like, you know, and so, you know, there are kids that were just into, like, the kind of wacky, zany thing. There's this kid, Brandon at my high school that was like, you know, a big lizard in my backyard and, you know, drawing pro-life stuff in the yearbook. You know, just like...
Really?
Yeah,
like,
I don't know.
Weird. Like, to be offensive or just...
I don't know. I think he was into that stuff. Like, okay. So there was that like, just did not feel like what punk really meant or whatever. Yeah. And then there's... things were desperate and that there was this other element of like, I'm going to go see whatever goofball stuff, you know.
It just was not, conducive with like...
Yeah.
And then
there's,
you know,
there's other things going on, you know, like the, you know, there's Black Flag tapes and Misfits tapes and Minor Threat tapes being passed around and bands that are forming in that sort of lineage and playing like, you know, high school kids doing that extension, that idea. And then there's all the New York kind of tough guy hardcore that I didn't really connect with either, the sort of those bands were around. And you go see them and be fine, but it was like, I'm not trying to like...
It's not your punk.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be like a football dude smashing heads. And that really was like the energy of a lot of that stuff.
Certainly. I guess now it's more intermixed. You know, like you can have like this sort of like anti-intellectual vibe of the band live, but then like there's like this sort of real deep poetic kind of like nihilism to the lyrics that they're trying to do. Like you can have your cake and eat it too a lot more now, I think.
Yeah.
There were bands, I guess, that kind of like, but more on the West Coast, that kind of had a darker kind of vibe.
Yeah.
that I guess would have sort of those moshy things. But yeah, you're right. It was, you know. So where did you eventually find like the music and scene that you kind of felt most comfortable with?
There were there were great shows happening at the Franklin Y of like kids, yeah. like contemporaries of ours in Philadelphia. There were shows happening. There's like, you know, even like the metal places at the time would occasionally let teenagers and weirdo bands or punk bands play or get on yeah. the bill. There's a place called Bonnie Rocks in Atco, New Jersey that, you know, it's probably where Metallica would have been playing in 83, 84, 85. And then
it's kind of crossover too, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. But they would be open to like occasionally letting, you know, one of our bands jump on the bill yeah. along with like speed metal stuff that was happening. And then, you know, Guns N' Roses was a huge crossover where like they were acknowledged or accepted or enjoyed by skate kids and yeah. metal kids and punk kids and all that.
And then they did like talk about a punk lineage. Duff was in
yeah.
like so many amazing,
yeah.
unbelievable punk bands.
And so even within, like, once the kids, like, gave a chance to that rather than just straight-up hair metal Bon Jovi stuff, it was like, all right, like, you know, like, you're on a slightly better track yeah, now, like, but you still should fucking come see The Replacements.
I remember my dad got me a Poison Open Up and Say Ah tape
yeah.
and Guns N' Roses Appetite for Destruction.
Yeah.
And it felt really different. Like, I know, yeah, because I'd seen the video for Welcome to the Jungle, and I know they had, and yeah, Axl has the teased out hair on yeah. that, and I'm like, oh, maybe they are, like... Poison, but I didn't really like Poison, but Guns N' Roses just had this like edge to it.
Yeah.
And then I heard One in a Million and it bummed me out.
Yeah. So disappointing.
So hard.
Yeah.
It is crazy that is a real record
yeah.
that charted. And, you know, like, and I know people say shocking things now and things like that, but that is a holy geez that.
Yeah.
And I know there's the defense that they get, that is given by. Like to the lyrics being like, oh, it's a narrative that I'm trying to tell, and geez, those are
a lot. It's a bummer that like when you finally get the world's attention and have a chance to say what you want to say, like that's what you put out.
Yeah, like why would you? If I was in that situation, I'd be like, no, let's never reissue this. If I like, I would never want to be in the situation where I've said those things, but like, let's never put this out again. Let's not remind people of this song.
So also you've got to remember that time. You've got, you know, the more radical turn that happened within hip hop. You've got everything going on with Public Enemy from Yo Bum Lef Show onwards from like 87. And that was huge. Like that was maybe even more what we're listening to.
Yeah. So then. Did you feel like that? Cause I every time I read like a punk, like, you know, a spin piece on punk, there's yeah. always like the fact that they put like the Public Enemy record in there. And I love Public Enemy, but I'm always like, I wonder if that's, did you think that was as punk, or is it the attitude that you felt was punk?
Yeah, absolutely felt like that. The energy and the confrontation,
yeah.
and the density of the lyrics and all the world it was creating of its own felt exactly
like in
like
line,
it wasn't right. like, oh, here's this other category. It was yeah. like, this is on and the other side of the Maxell tape
I guess at the time, like,
yeah.
you know, it was, because like Chuck D, like, he would take on like weird band, like he asked us to open one time,
yeah.
you know, so there was totally. That kind of like aware, I guess, punk energy, punk awareness
yeah.
and stuff. And then didn't they do a tour? I'm trying to remember, it was like a tour. I thought they played.
They did a lot of shows, you know, they did shows regionally with Anthrax. They had
Anthrax,
a show in Chicago yeah. with Sonic Youth and them that ended in a police riot.
Oh, really? Yeah. Would that be around Cool Thing?
It was, man, I feel like it might have been pre-Cool Thing. Well, no, yeah, it would have been. It would have been around that time. Yeah.
So, like, at which point did you, like, decide, like, you know, you're obviously surviving, and that's
yeah.
the key to your existence at this point. When did you get to a point where you were able to or well enough to kind of, like, figure out what was going to happen beyond just survival?
I found some good supportive friends and people that would let me crash with them and... Mm-hmm. I was at Catholic school during high school, and there were even, like, you know, faculty or teachers that were looking out for me that I could crash with sometimes.
Yeah.
I also got into stuff that was more, like, you know, less punk, more The Smiths, R.E.M., other stuff that was, like, you know, music culture going on at that time, and really connected with a lot of it and got deep into some of that.
Which has, like, a real... both those bands have definitely... You know, that is an extension of punk in, you know, both cases, right? Like...
I would say so. Plenty of people would, you know, disagree.
People would disagree, but, like, I think there's a real tangible link, you know,
yeah.
like, between punk bands, you know. Like, obviously, R.E.M. would play with
yeah.
all the Athens and stuff, but, like, The Smiths, like, The Nosebleeds, like,
yeah.
you know, and Slaughter and the Dogs, and
totally.
There's all these, like, ties to, like,
yeah.
that world.
And I certainly, like, was, you know, someone who had a strong tolerance for non-dumbed-down, non-regressive, non, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know.
Yeah.
was totally into the stuff that was like heading in those other directions as well. So I got deep into some of that stuff, and Michael Stipe from REM had a film group at the time called C100 Film Corps that was giving grants to underground filmmakers. And they had sort of realized that there was this back door to get content on the air, that there were, you know, sort of mandates of how much time within the United States had to get given from the broadcasting spectrums to public service announcements. Mm-hmm. And then if you made really strong content in that format, that would end up getting aired on your local NBC affiliate, you know, several times a day.
So they were actually doing this kind of stuff then.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, you can sell this much time to, like, yeah, commercials, and then you've got to, like, you know,
do some sort
2 minutes a day has to be public service announcement type of stuff. Yeah. So by just, like, making content about progressive issues in that format and making these little 30-second or 15-second spots and then sending the tapes out to all the different broadcast affiliates, like, these things would end up on the air. So, like, Jem Cohen or Jim McKay or Catherine Diekman or these interesting, like, progressive artists and filmmakers that Michael was running into would get little grants and make these things, and they would end up, like, running. You could see weird Jem Cohen imagery
on NBC
about, like, where trash goes. Yeah. And so they, when I was still a teenager, kind of helped get me some grants to, like, keep making films and getting it processed and looking stuff as giving and kind of giving notes, and tapped me into his sort of like art and film culture that he had around him, and was extremely nurturing and kind of helped get me down with an artist named Chris Bilheimer to Athens, Georgia, when I was still probably like 17 years old or so. And there's a painter and filmmaker named James Herbert, who's sort of from the Stan Brakhage experimental filmmaker lineage. He was an amazing artist, and moved into his place, and you know, I spent some time in a dorm as well. You know, but basically, like, ended up living in this great,
creative
old Southern house, and you know, making artwork and painting and film. And there's no film school. There's no, like, you don't learn how to light an interview or there's nothing like that. It's
did you ever go to film school?
No,
oh, so it's all like self-taught.
Yeah,
like on that side.
Exactly. So just was making things with no training.
Wow. Okay.
And then had these like artists who are nurturing. You know, there's like other students where you would go make a Super 8 film with, you know, with no.
I guess you're almost like apprenticing and mentoring with like these other artists.
Too. Yeah, but there's nothing about lighting or, you know what I mean.
Yeah,
it's just like, you know, other weirdos and kooks making stuff and putting in a projector and watching it together and seeing what was exciting or not. So that was just a great process, and Athens was an incredibly creative time, you know, place to be, and a lot of great stuff going on. And there was maybe a transition from sort of punk stuff to this sort of, you know, indie rock or college radio thing that was going on at the time.
The Athens scene, was like Let's Active and Pylon and all those.
Yeah, so Pylon had reformed and was doing stuff again. So they were around and they were great. Michael Hefsky's an amazing guy.
I love that band.
So wonderful,
great band.
But there were a lot of these sort of like bands that were maybe reacting against that sound, or that like were worried about being associated with REM because they were from Athens. And so they were going like noisy, like Porn Orchard or the Jackonuts or the Barbecue Killers or, you know, 5-8 or Mercy Land, Dave Barbie's group at the time. So like more aggressive, like more fucked
noise,
up
more like the noise rock kind of vibe, I guess, at the time too.
And so that was going on with people that are older than me. And then the younger kids were the ones that were showing up to kind of start all the Elephant Six Collective. Like Jeff Mangum came in maybe in 93 from Rustin, Louisiana, and Bill Doss, and, you know, those guys were around and playing at, you know, burrito restaurants and just doing Circulatory System.
Building the scene.
Yeah, kind of building the scene, Synthetic Flying Machine. So pre-Nutrimilk Hotel stuff that these guys were doing that was extremely, like, from the get-go, like, so exciting, and realizing, like, this really feels like the sort of Van Morrison or some moments of John Lennon visionary channel for songs coming through him that, you know, like this, and started filming everything that Jeff was doing at that time.
So you were like right at the start of Nutrimilk Hotel, kind of like there and part of that.
And kind of like filming and documenting all that. And also like from like 91, 92 onwards, with the cameras and stuff, started like jumping in the van with bands like Pavement and, you know, like going on the road and shooting footage and, and there's another great, kind of great band from Athens at that time called 5-8 that were like a three-piece bass guitar drums, you know, sounded kind of like Crazy Horse or Husker Du.
Okay.
And toured the country with them extensively, and they would just kind of build these routes, like leaving hitting like weird places in the South, and then sometimes going for, you know, going across the whole country when they could.
When you're filming this footage, is it just like, is the goal to like do an art film with it, or is the goal is that this needs to get
documented, and it's not going to end up, as long as like Tonight belongs to Michelob ads are happening with Eric Clapton, like this stuff is getting like, again, like suffocated or drowned or snuffed out, and like it's up to me to like film this first.
Did you have like
a Fugazi show, because it's not otherwise going to get filmed, you know?
But did you have like a, like, because now if someone was to say I'm going to start filming shows, the ultimate end result is very obvious where it's going to go, the internet. But like, did you have any idea of what exhibition or any sort of
plan? Like the best that I could do would be to like make a VHS dub and hand it to Thurston when Sonic Youth came through town. You know, that was about the extent of what you, I was projecting stuff. I was showing stuff at the 40 Watt Club in a place called the Downstairs in Athens. I started screening films with Michael Lehofsky, and I started a thing called Flickr, where we would do like, you know, monthly screenings of Super 8 film. But there's like a no video rule for that, where we were like purists about it having to be like shot on film and projected on film. But so the stuff I was shooting on like, you know, Hi8 or camcorders of like live performances of bands just felt like it was important to me to document it. I would listen to that or watch that. I would put it on at home, and you know, that'd be, you know, a 45-minute super chunk set would I would watch it again and again.
Were you tape trading? Because like we would,
there's a little bit of that, but I was not
late. But we're late.
I would say later. So it's just sort of like on my own kind of archiving stuff, and you know, getting a better eye or better sense of like intuition of like, okay, now Laura Balance is going to step forward and do this on the, you know, getting a sense of like how to cover things with a single camera in real time as they unfolded.
Did you know John from going to shows in Philly?
I don't think we ever crossed. I don't think that I knew him in Philly. And again, not to be, I mean, he's an amazing guy and a genius. But like, if I had known him at the time, I probably would have been like, oh,
he's in Psychotic
Goofball.
Norman,
which is goofy. You know, like I had less time for, the stakes were too high. But I certainly adore him. And, you know, so I guess I was filming Superchunk before he was drumming, but then continued on once he was in the band.
Were you filming when they were just...
I believe so, because they came down to Athens. Like they were, you know.
I guess it would have been pretty local.
Yeah,
for like kind
of. It wasn't that far of a stretch for them to.
Yeah, you know, drive down.
At least that's how I remember it. And then there, you know, there like people were putting on weird shows and house shows, and so like weirdo bands from the Northwest would come down and just like play a train station and in Athens. You know, it was a mythical place
to
Athens
go. Athens is like the spot. Like, you know, like,
you wanted to go there. But you were also isolated and cut off. Like there was no national. You know, like you weren't. It was it's a weird thing. Little pocket,
and it's weird because like I don't think I've ever played there. Like we do Atlanta, but we just and it's like it's such a like 40 Watt Club is still a legendary club that's there, and I just don't think we've ever played there. Yeah. Like I'm trying to think now, and I'm of course going to be like an idiot again and be like, oh, I played there and had an amazing time, like, and it was like the best venue of my night. But still, I don't think I have. But like it's funny because I guess. Did you feel that scene kind of dry up at any point? Because like
no, because always like some new variation would happen, or something. You know, every year there's a bunch of 18-year-old kids showing up who are interested in invent something new, and there's always fun stuff going on. There's a band called Shade right now that are great.
Yeah, no, I don't mean like there's like nothing, but like there was like that moment where it was like pre-Seattle, it was like the hub, and stuff. Like, did you feel like were you? You were still there, obviously, when that kind of felt like it was, because I was like 90.
Yeah. Kind of. No, it felt exciting and great. And even if things weren't like, if 5/8 wasn't on the cover of Spin Magazine,
yeah,
it's
don't
still,
care. They're an amazing band.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Things were really rewarding, exciting, and you could make art and people would go see it, and you could paint and then ship, you know, show it at the Downstairs. You know, there's just a great supportive place. You get away with spoken word.
Yeah.
So I loved it, but it also, when you would go on tour with these bands, like it was sort of the commercialization of that indie rock thing started happening at that time, where basically, you know, Jane's Addiction broke through and we're uniting metalheads and classic rock dudes and Zeppelin people and punks by, you know.
Yeah, by just
hitting all those things. And then when Nirvana, and even before Nirvana, like I think people, there were things that kind of got relatively large before Nirvana, like, you know,
Pixie.
Yeah,
I guess,
they were filling large venues, and so were like Soundgarden, and you know.
But it's kind of like Canadian rap pre Drake.
Yeah,
you know, where it's like it seemed like, well, they were big artists, but then it's like, you know, when Nirvana comes, it just all seems so small by comparison.
Yeah. And Nirvana was so significant and so important to me, and just transcendently affected me that.
Were you into Bleach? And
oh, yeah. I mean, like, the whole way through. And then, like, knowing, like, when they did that Sliver 7-inch and, like, the combination of the artwork and the perfection of that song.
Yeah.
Like, it felt like this, like, something's going on here. This is
going to click.
Yeah, this is going to click. Even that Blue EP that came out, like, there was a build to it, and the photography, yeah, and the choices they're making, and the way that they're approaching songs, and the live shows that they're doing at that time. You did feel this trajectory that, like, you know, this is special. This is different than what's happening with Soundgarden.
Did you film?
I did, yeah. And then I put together, like, the box set.
The box set is on the box set's footage. That's right, because I have that box set, too.
So they were incredibly important and just meant the world to me. And, you know, at that time, and you felt like sometimes within culture you find or recognize people that have maybe been through similar experiences or feelings that you have, and that you connect with them. And, like, that was something I really locked in with Kurt, that it felt like there were some shared experiences there. And so that band meant the world to me, and being involved with them is one of the things that I'm glad before I eventually die that happened, and that was part of my time on this planet. So they, you know, they came through Athens, they came through Atlanta, they were great. Other people recognized it too. Like, you know, my friend Chris Bilheimer, this artist that was looking out for me, like, I'm sure one of the best live things he ever saw was watching them there at the 40 Watt. Greg in Atlanta, who's, like, filming shows there, like, made a point to go, like, really do a good job filming whenever Nirvana came through there. You know, people were picking up on it or cognizant that this was special. You know, like, you can have fun at a Fishbone show, but, like, the Nirvana show, like, get it right. Like, this is, you know,
recorded. Something special.
So it was great. It was exciting. I was happy to see the rest of the world catch on and get excited. And, like, it was
a vindicate. Like,
I didn't.
Taking my music.
I wanted it. I wanted, like, all the numbskulls who were still dragging their Poison Liquid the Cat dragged in cassette, like, to, like, throw that out the car window and, like, just listen to Come As You Are.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted that. I thought it was sort of like a shift in what would end up on the radio or power. You know, it felt like, okay, maybe we don't have to have another The Night Belongs to Michelob ad if this can be what...
If this can hit.
So, there were so many rumors pre-internet about, like, what the next moves were, what was happening. Mm-hmm. Like, because, like, immediately when you saw the other major labels, like, shift and manufacture, remarket things that they had to go more in that Nirvana trajectory... And, like, I resented Pearl Jam so much.
Yeah.
Like, it felt so fucked that, like, these totally hooked up guys that had, like, huge articles, you know, before they'd even put, you know, just, they were, like, groomed and rigged to be this sort of, like, dude bro metal thing. And then it's like, we're also, like, this guy used to be in a punk band. Like, you know, the sort of, like, reshifting of how they're being marketed right at that launch was such a bummer. And then they had that whole machine behind them, and that, like, lunkhead drummer dude. It's, everything about them was so repulsive. But, you know, like, Eddie Vedder seemed like a decent guy, or that, like, whatever he was going through was a similar, like, recognition. But, like, why choose these numbskulls to be, you know? So there was a rumor going around that, like, when they were coming through and touring, like, they were going to come play, like, whatever student thing, you know, outdoor swimming pool thing in the University of Georgia, that Nirvana were driving around in a van and showing up in every city that Pearl Jam played on that tour and doing, like, house shows or punk shows to draw the cool kids away from the Pearl Jam show. And we were so excited about that idea. And, like, we were like, all right, like, has anyone seen the van show up? Like, you know, like, where are they doing this? And it turned out not to be true, but it was, like, such a great idea. And it felt like that's what should be happening.
They're like, it's like the Beatles, Rolling Stones, Clash, Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
It's like Nirvana, Pearl Jam. Like a real divide, you can see, because I remember just being like, there's something that's not, and I got, like, that music was before I was even aware necessarily. I knew it was aware of punk, but, like, it just didn't feel like Nirvana felt.
Yeah, and, you know, again, like, Eddie Vedder's a great guy.
Yeah, like, I'm sure, like, I love Green River, and I love Direct Diction, Jeff Armand's band from Missouri or something, or anywhere. No, Montana.
Montana.
Yeah. And, like, I think those bands are awesome and everything like that. But, yeah, it's just...
At the time, it felt, again, like, this is, like, a dangerous diversion away from what looked like a singular thing that was happening culturally, and now it's getting, like... Because they were already, like, I'm sure he was already doing, like, fronting as Jim Morrison for Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductions for, like, Ray Manzarek's version of the, you know, like,
yeah,
they were so hooked up in that world. It was like, ah, yeah. And like, Ray Manzarek's a fucking ghoul. Like, he lived off the corpse of Jim Morrison for decades. And like, you know, just,
yeah,
it's such a grotesque, self-indulgent side to all that stuff that was like a complete bummer to me as a, you know,
well, I guess that for you also as someone
teenager.
That, yeah, well, someone that you hate, that hated that adult,
yeah,
hippie holdover
exactly
culture so
yeah
much.
That, yeah, that was an extension of that, yeah.
Are there any bands from that period that you've been able to go back and rediscover and be like, ah, this isn't so bad?
I mean, I guess I got into Syd Barrett stuff early on, and like, oh, yeah, that, yeah, I was always fine weird with, but like, I still can't, I just, like, something triggers
like
too much in
reaction,
me, yeah.
So, when did you leave Athens? When did you actually, like, apart from getting in the vans, obviously?
Yeah. I guess I started exploring other parts of the country while touring with bands from the early 90s onwards. And I would say, like, in 92, went to Portland, Oregon, and just connected with it and felt like, mm-hmm, okay, this place feels right. This place is fucked up. This, I could hide here. There were great bands. There was Jody Bliley from the band Hazel was like a... I sort of had people I'd really connect with or respond to that felt like signifiers or walking saints or people that were like, there's some recognition of like what my life experience had been and what they looked like they were dealing with or had been through. And so really connected with like her in Portland and loved what she was doing with her band Hazel and then Team Dresch when she put that together. Mm-hmm. Elliot Smith, just like characters that you knew, like this is, you know, this is what I want
to
see while I'm on Earth.
To these people.
So I started going back and forth to Portland, and it was a cheap enough place at the time, and Athens was so cheap that, like, I'm not, you know, I'm sure there were times that Jim Herbert wasn't really even charging me rent. You know, just you'd have a room in this crazy gothic southern house with, like, painters and characters and photographers, and you could, like, listen to music and walk down the hall and look at someone working on a new painting. It was just such a magical experience.
Yeah.
And kudzu growing over everything, and... you know, but like the cost of living was so low in both places that you could go back and forth and get a room in a house in Portland and a group house and just make it work. So it was a weird bi-coastal thing that was not the traditional New York-LA axis, but rather two like underground areas.
Well, it's like Washington, D.C.
And Olympia.
Olympia had that kind of kinship, I guess.
Yeah. So after I moved out of Jim Herbert's house, I moved into a warehouse building that he had that was sort of a former high school gymnasium, and then the classes where they would teach things like health, like the auxiliary classes. With two great artists, Chris Pilheimer and Dan Donahue. And we would just, like, you know, have bands play and put on shows and make artwork and put on events and stuff there. And it was incredibly cheap. Like, it might have been, like, $100 a month to have this huge, great space that one noticed was there.
It's almost like this. It's kind of, like, pricing itself out of these cities now. Like, you could not
find
that in Portland or...
And, you know, a lot of that goes to Jim being incredibly supportive of artists and just the feeling at that place that you weren't being a mercenary about stuff. You weren't trying to be predatory. You were just enabling other culture to exist and get spawned. So, you know, similarly, you could get a room in a group house in Portland for not much money and just kind of go back and forth. So that's what I was doing. And then kind of taking...
Just like hitch rides on tours back and forth?
Yeah, hitch rides on tours or you know, Delta is hubbed out of Atlanta. And so there's like inexpensive direct flights, you know, back and forth as well. And there's no sales tax in Oregon, and there's really low cost and stuff of living in Athens. You know, there were very cheap places to kind of get by.
Yeah.
So, you know, would travel with band. And then also started, like, from the early 90s onwards, like, there was a move, I think, when My Bloody Valentine came through, and they were doing projections behind them, and they had, like, maybe Dinosaur, you know, same kind of people around them as, like, Dinosaur Jr. and Mercury Rev. They just started, like, having me, you know, tag along or help run projectors or make content to put on screens and run behind them and then film stuff. It became a way to, like, without ever having gone to film school or try to become, like, a music video director, which is what people were doing at that time for that sort of thing, just, like, would work with bands or make things or whatever. And, you know, again, like, when R.E.M. would just need to do some, like, background projections for a tour or award acceptance speech or whatever, like, they were great about, like, helping us to get a chance to make stuff. And then toured extensively when, like, R.E.M. and Sonic Youth did shows in 95, Michael had his own bus and kind of took me out to go travel around, and I made all the stuff they were projecting behind them during certain songs.
Okay.
And again, like, other people that I adored, like,
I guess that's by that point you were kind of used to it, but that still, like, to have your work seen by that.
It was insane. Yeah, it was incredible. And it was such a, you know, there were certain songs that I really connected with and deliberately made stuff. And the footage was a lot of, like, other runaway kids and teenagers in parking lots and laundromats and gas stations. And, I traveled the country shooting it and was going to the places I was, like, fixated or obsessed with, like, Louisville, Kentucky, like, going up there chasing ghosts of the stories about the guys in Slint, and then, like, also shooting the current teenagers and making these things to project. So to go see that projected like at Madison Square Garden with the song Country Feedback, and like they're running multiple screens of all the footage and, you know, overlapping. It's just, yeah. And then the band's actually like kind of playing to it and altering the timing of stuff in cadence with what's happening with the visuals, that like Michael would turn and face the screens to watch them during that song. That it was this incredibly validating and, you know, inspiring, exciting thing. And then you'd go out afterwards and it's like Lou Reed and Patti Smith coming up to be like, that was beautiful, you know. So you felt like, fuck everybody that wanted me dead. Like, you know,
this is it. This like, I found my space.
Yeah. And then just even like, they were such good people in the world around them. Like, you were, you know, from early on in the 90s, like Ian MacKaye and Jem Cohen, like the people around Michael were good punk character people to learn from and get a sense of how to operate in the world, what sort of choices to make, what integrity to kind of build into yourself.
So, you know, you're obviously kind of living in two worlds where you're screening stuff in smaller art spaces and then also getting this thing. And now your work is mass viewed. Was there like ever a conflict internally about like...
Yeah, there were times that you had to turn down things. Like I just, this story came up. I've been doing some stuff recently with a band, Screaming Females, from New Jersey.
Yeah.
And Marissa, awesome, who's younger than me, is... you know, she grew up like liking the Smashing Pumpkins and stuff like that. And it reminded me of the story that I completely blocked out or forgotten about, that, you know, there's a window probably like whenever they were doing stuff in 94 or something, you know, that that they asked about me making stuff to project behind them or work with them. And I'd like that record Gish when it came out, you know, the drum sounds are really cool. But you were starting to hear stories about Billy Corgan being a complete creep or whatever. And then like when I would go up and down the East Coast, I would stay at Ian's house, the sort of the house, the Discord house that's on the cover.
The famous.
Yeah. That's where I would crash during the drives. And so I went and had all my cameras and like, you know, parked my beat up car and went to go up to the bedroom and crash out. And Ian was like, this is great. Great to see you. And like, you know, traded some stories. He's like, so where are you headed to go do? And I was like, I'm going to go like meet this band, the Smashing Pumpkins. They want me to like make stuff to project behind them. And he just kind of sat me down and was like, man, what are you doing? Like, you know, like you make this work. Why would you want to do that? Why would you want that to be like what you spent your time with? Like you're only going to have so many images in your mind. Why would you burn a bunch of those with that band? Like, what do you get out of that? And I was like, yeah, like, you know, but it, me, I didn't
you
have
the literal Ian MacKaye that sits on every punk's shoulder in front of you.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, but like at the time it was like, well, I didn't have a job. Yeah, it was like, you know, it's like, oh, here's this pile of money to go make something.
I understand. I think a lot more than Ian does. Yeah.
But so it really like sank in and it was like, yeah, like what am I doing? And then realized like maybe I'll find some way to like not take that and just keep making other weird stuff and get by and not pay, you know, like whatever sacrifices you make, but like then you're not the guy that did the stuff for the Smashing Pumpkins in 94. So I think I went and saw them play their show and it was a bummer. Like watching like what they're up to at that time and the vibe in the band, you know, it just felt like, yeah, these aren't, I don't recognize the same thing I get out of Nirvana and R.E.M. and Elliott Smith and Jody Bliley. And, you know, like, I feel like, yeah, this is a different thing. And there's an even
like
more horrific thing. And there was an even more horrific thing before that where the band Mercury Rev were not really a real band. Like I didn't know it at the time. Basically, like they were this recording project that Dave Friedman had done, and then all the weirdos at the campus, he put this person to play flute on a song and this person to do spoken word, but like they didn't all really know each other. They weren't like a real functional band. And then like in the post-Nirvana signing fringe, because like that record had been pressed by Rough Trade in England right around the time that like Rough Trade in the US like went bankrupt. Mm-hmm. Like I think inboxes or like shrink wrap copies of this record ready to go, that it was all like a weird signing story. Like the tape was being passed around as a way for Dave Friedman to get production work. It got misunderstood as being an
demo.
Active band, you know, and then it's like, this is great, let's put this out. And then he had to like bring the people together to like, oh, remember, like you recorded a thing for my thing. You're like, can you come? So they got signed to like Columbia Sony Records in the post Nirvana alternative rock era. And I didn't know it. I was like young, and they basically like asked if I would like project stuff behind them while they did like a Lollapalooza tour in 93. Yeah. And I, you know, it's like, yeah, that sounds great. I might have been like 20 years old at the time. And asked for like some small amount of like per diem to go do this whole thing. And then realized like, wait, they're playing like outdoors in Denver, Colorado at 2 p.m. Like there's no way to see a movie.
Yeah.
I'm super 8 there. Yeah. Like it just doesn't physically work. But because of what they're doing is just like embezzling money out of their label is like tour advances and tour support. They're like, well, just come film instead. Or, you know, it was a way of them like siphoning off some pile of money from the label
to get, like...
For themselves.
Yeah.
To divide up, like, as an advance. So, I travel the country, like, not knowing what I got myself into, and that was, like, what the dynamic was. And they're completely dysfunctional. And
you're
like,
committed to it.
Yeah,
it's,
like,
point.
All this stuff. But so you would get to, like, the Northwest and, like, find Kill Sybil or Patty Schimmel drumming. And,
yeah.
You know, like, okay, these are the things I want to connect with.
So, yeah, so, like, so you were finding stuff to where you could, exhibit your work and get out there.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, there is a point where you start making other stuff that isn't necessarily music, right? Like,
I've directed, like, a lot of documentaries, a lot of films, so a lot of comedy stuff. But there was a period of time where I would, you know, direct music videos for bands or
commercials or things like that. Yeah, was it, do you still find your personal art to do?
Yeah, because I guess, like, the stuff that's, like, more personal music related is, like, one side of things. And then just by a weird fluke, I ended up shooting the Jackass stuff.
Okay, yeah.
Through Spike Jones, who was, like, a great supportive person that kind of spotted me and brought me out to L.A. to do stuff with him in the mid-90s. Maybe we met through Sonic Youth or something, I would imagine.
Yeah, because he shot Dirty? Or 100% the skate stuff, right?
Yeah.
Can we stop for one second?
Yeah, of course.
I just want to double check because it's getting a weird...
Spike was great and started bringing me out to kind of help work on stuff or shoot with him or figure out ways to approach things. And that was incredibly rewarding. And so through that, you know, ended up working on some feature films and commercials and weird things in that world. But that felt different from, I mean, I was good at that, but that was different from the sort of personal work that I was doing. And then just as a fluke, like when he kind of helped, he created that show Jackass with his friends, Johnny Knoxville and Jeff Tremaine.
Did you know Big Brother magazine at all? Like, you were familiar with that?
Yeah.
Like, were you involved in the skate scene?
Probably? I don't want to overstate my involvement in the skate scene.
I
certainly, like, had a board and skated on streets in Alabama, but I was not in any way, like, shredding bowls like the real people were. And I think there was an assumption that I could, like, hang or shoot skate stuff, but, like, I wasn't really that nimble on a skateboard to, like, shoot great stuff
right
while
along.
Skating. You know?
Yeah.
So... But I was good at the sort of the personality or getting people to open up or be candid or be funny to camera. So they kind of like would use me in Jackass stuff as a way of if they knew they had like a higher stakes shoot, like if we were doing Brad Pitt or effects makeup of Knoxville's an old man and needed to not blow it, like they would bring me in to kind of have
to
additional
be the one
coverage.
To shoot it.
That sounds dickish too. I like to get additional coverage and make sure that like I don't want to But like basically like if they were worried about like we don't want to not have the Brad
Pitt. Yeah, you want to have a second camera on everything and make sure it's good.
Shot some of that stuff for the TV show and then when it was time to do that first movie and no one believed that it could be a movie or like why would anyone watch this for 90 minutes or whatever. The idea was that maybe if I went and shot sort of a documentary side of like conversations and the prep and like what happens afterwards and how this all works that would like stitch the film together and make it work. And then it ended up being that like we didn't need as much explanation as we thought we might before once you start watching those things cut together, like it's just fun and it all makes sense and you don't need like a narrative structure. And
it's almost like the pre YouTube supercut of just stunts, it flows really good. Like a narrative, there is a narrative kind of flow to that movie too.
And so, you know, Dmitry Eliashvich, the main DP for that stuff is great. And I just had a good time with those guys like shooting and jumping into that world. And again, I don't come from like a extreme sports action bro dude.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Because, like, I'm not that I said I misread you, but I think a lot of people would assume, especially because, like, you know, and just the types of artists that lately you've been working with, that's more the world you come from. But it's I don't know what I expected you to say your first interaction was, but I didn't expect you to recite a Patti Smith poem.
Yeah. No, that was definitely like, that's the weird conflict in my, what people's perception of me is now, is it like really come from this sort of like, poetic background.
Yeah.
And then it was funny to the Jackass guys that like, oh, here's, you know, this guy that's like trying to listen to a Team Dresh tape on the van ride is like,
but like, Aaron's from Portland.
Nick Bimble. Let's not make him.
Okay.
He's from like a goofy sub.
Okay, fine. Okay. The area.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Was he like at all involved? Well, no, actually I've met Aaron enough to know that there's no way he was going to Team Dresh concerts.
But Knoxville is a genuine, smart, sharp
dude
who was, like, totally fluent in punk culture and, you know, he knows what's up.
Well, like, Ryan was a punk dude, too.
For
like,
sure.
Yeah, they were, like, there were that connection to that kind of stuff, too.
Definitely. And Jeff Tremaine, like, a lot, you know, the choices, you know, it's all this kind of, like, SST bad brains using the Minutemen as a theme.
Oh, the
like,
music,
they're from
you know, why I gravitated that show. Well, I was a big, I knew Big Brother, I was a fan of Big Brother, but, like... You know, like, oh, Minuteman. Like, you kind of, like, you saw the signpost to know that it was cool.
Yeah, definitely.
So going from, like, I guess that was like, was that, what would you consider like your breakthrough to kind of like a more mainstream kind of audience? Like, I guess that would have been it, right?
That would have been it. Like, you know, you were, I was working movie. On stuff that, yeah, that again, that was like, that was, yeah, that was not on purpose. That was,
no,
I was trying to stay kind of hidden, or is I wouldn't do interviews for the longest time. I wouldn't appear in photos. It was like trying to negate myself from being any attention for most of the 90s and sort of like, and then sometimes it'd be funny because like there'd be magazine articles that come out and they would refer to like, you know, as Nirvana, whatever, like an unseen camera quietly lingers in the back. And it'd be like, now I kind of wish like, oh, I like maybe it should have said, you know, Lance Banks is filming or whatever. Yeah. You know, there was too many of those things that happened in a funny way. Well, it's funny, but at the time, that's what I was going
for. Well, there's certain people that document scenes that are so, like the first one to be like, I was this guy. I'm that dude that took that thing.
Yeah, I never felt the need to insert myself.
To validate it that way.
Yeah, the kind of like the first like where I would just get recognized from people on the street was definitely once the Jackass films came out. And again, like was trying to be not in those movies, but I think they liked the humor of this, you know, Jem Cohen type person that was like
reacting to
reacting to like Steve-O's discharges.
So when it comes down to like, you know, working with artists now and stuff like that, is that something that you kind of like, you probably get to pick and choose at this point who you work with. And is it like, is something you find yourself, do you have to respond to the work that they do? Or is it more like, I think I can see a visual for what they're doing?
Yeah, it's kind of, I would say that sometimes I'm willing to like try things or push myself to do things that aren't really my aesthetic, but that like I see something among them that seems interesting. Like I've done a bunch of work with like Earl Sweatshirt, Sid the Kid, the Frank Ocean, Tyler, the people from Odd Future. Yeah. And at first that was hard to explain to people. Like I met and knew them in the context I was making a film about underground culture on Fairfax Avenue. There's a family bookstore, which is this great art bookstore.
Yeah. Is it like the guy from Fucked? Or no, like some street worker?
Kramer's Ergot, and just some really good people that are sort of like an underground publishing and art and comics that are there that run this great bookstore. And it's become the street that, like, was a sort of a traditional Jewish neighborhood that's now become, like, streetwear. You know, it's like where Supreme has a store and all that sort of thing. But at the time I was filming that transition, you know, it was like an art enclave. Weird performances were going on, you know, music, weirdo things were happening. And was filming that. And then, like, in the background of that documentary, you've got these, like, 14, 15-year-old kids, like, skating and doing crazy stuff and being really, like, charismatic and funny and weirdos. And
do they
like,
recognize you from Jackass?
Yeah. And so there's some like, hey, like you're the guy from Jackass. Yeah. And then just realized that like there are some weird personalities here and they all these great names like Tyler the Creator and Earl Sweatshirt and, you know, and it was like, wow, like what's this subculture? What's going on here? Like sort of black skateboarding artist weirdos, you know, listening to Joy Division, you know, it's like, this is interesting. So that was sort of like, I don't know, like late 2000s and started shooting footage with them. And then Nick Weidenfeld, who does like, you know, was doing Adult Swim at the time, like also connected with them and was like excited about like, what do we do with this energy and these weirdo kids? And then like Earl kind of got sent off around that time. But like Sid was fascinating, the work she was doing and knowing she was this like lesbian teenager making these records. Yeah. It was like, there was all these layers of nuance and like shade.
Yeah, because it's a fascinating, like that's the thing is like, even no matter how your take on, you know, the stuff that gets put out.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating group to look at.
Yeah.
There's just so many dynamics where it's not, you can't dismiss it on any level because there's other things at play.
Yeah. So knowing that stuff before other people kind of were allowed to know it, like there was reasons for me to kind of get excited or want to film or keep documenting like what was going on with this contingent. And then, but on the sort of like when it's just like Tyler the Creator's Twitter feed and you're like, this is repulsive, that people were like, what are you doing? Or, you know, why are you spending time down there filming them or whatever? And then it's like, you know, you don't want to out people before they're, you know, but like, there were complicated things going on that were like, I was drawn to kind of like be the one documenting and film and build an archive of.
I would not want to be staying at the Discord house though.
Yeah, exactly.
Having to explain that to you.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, we did that show, Loiter Squad. We did a bunch of documentary stuff over the years. So there's that side of things. And I've developed a mind, like, again, I never went to film school, never did, like, proper training, but, like, know how to put together a TV show, know how to put together, you know, comedy events or things like that now, and have had a good time doing that, directing a lot of comedy stuff lately. And that's rewarding to kind of, like, go into some other field or branch of things. But then also to kind of keep making music work or, you know, go do personal films. Like I put out a film about the band Slint that I was working on for, you know, most of the past 20 odd years.
Well, you're saying you're going down there and filming it way back when.
Yeah.
So that's like, that must be like the passion project.
Yeah, for sure. Like that was just like a film that I kind of willed into being over the course of several decades.
Are there any other bands that you have like that footage of that you've
There's a lot of things like that that we haven't put out.
Like, tell me what projects are in the works.
You know, like I filmed everything with Jeff Mangum while he was in Athens and putting together this record. We were housemates. Once I left the kind of school building, I moved into the house with Jeff and the rest of Nutrimilk Hotel when they were kind of putting together stuff around in the airplane over the sea. And then the time period after that when he kind of like started going into seclusion and was, you know, kind of around for all that and have footage and just haven't figured out a way that he'd be comfortable like showing or putting it out, but sort of have those archives. And then went on tour, like also responded to Arcade Fire in 2004 when they put out Funeral, and they had me jump in the van and just kind of went and documented everything that was going on. So there's all the footage.
Were you there when they burnt Richard?
There's footage of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause like, that came up on the podcast.
Yeah. There's, you know, David Bowie walking in the room and meeting them for the first time, David Byrne coming in and biking up to the show and then working on an arrangement of Naive Melody and playing that, you know, it's all this like stuff as it unfolds in real time. And, you know, very smartly so at the end of that tour, when we cut stuff together and looked at it, it felt like this is really cool, but man, how incredibly self-indulgent would it be for a band to put out like a 90-minute documentary about their first record like 4 months later, you know? So we just sort of like ditched that and then trying to figure out if it makes sense to put it out at some point or do something with it. But so that exists. There's been like, other things like that where I've just been interested in someone and sort of like built an archive of footage. At the moment, I'm shooting a lot with that band Screaming Females and was inspired. Like there's some connection there, something like some recognition like we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And they came through the Milestone, which is like a long running punk venue in North Carolina.
North Carolina, absolutely.
It might be one of the longest continuous running venues for that world.
I think it's funny, like there's not too many of those left.
Yeah.
You know, like CB's obviously gone and
so basically, when we shot the film Bad Grandpa, we had to be really low-key. We were going to a lot of places people would not expect a hidden camera movie to be filmed. A lot of, you know, Gary, Indiana, different parts of North and South Carolina. And shooting footage and trying to not let anybody know that you were in town doing this. Because, like, it ruins the effect if people, you know, are looking out for it. So I would, at night, again, like, with those guys, like, they, you know, they might go to Buffalo Wild Wings and drink or whatever and watch an NBA game. And it's like, oh, that's not my scene. I'm, you know, I would head over and go find like, oh man, like Screaming Females are playing at the Milestone, and just kind of head over there alone. And couldn't tell them what I was doing. You know, it's like, well, what are you doing in North Carolina? Where, you know, where's Corin?
I'm here for Slater Kinney here. Bojangles.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, you can't really say. And then they came back through Portland on this recent tour and realized that like, there's just some connection there where we started shooting stuff and it jumped in the van with them across the Deep South. And it was a lot of places I'd gone with like Pavement, Nirvana, Sonic Youth in the early 90s, 5/8, that you go back now and things are better. Like in Birmingham, Alabama, there's a record store and there's like queer kids and more of a mixed audience and like more races represented at this show than there would have been at a Superchunk show in 91. You know, like there were things of like, you know, word's gotten out, there's cultures being built, communities coming together in a better way now because of the internet or access information or just like things getting easier on people.
I think it's also like, you know, the stuff we've been probably talking about too, like, you know, just these little, you know, mainstream kind of like science.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, you do this in the small town.
And it was so inspiring to me. Like, they went and played like a place in Delta College, and it's either Cleveland, Mississippi, or Cincinnati. I think it's Cleveland, Mississippi. Okay. And it's just in the middle of nowhere. And like, this band is in a van. They're making a point to go play to whatever kids are going to come out.
Yeah.
It's a cheap all ages show. And they read the book Our Band Could Be Your Life and like bought into it, and like they're on board. They're, you know, because like my sense of the world, and I am glad to see that I'm slightly wrong, was that like too much of it, of like bands that are active now, are like, we're playing at the Vitamin Water stage, at the Fader Ford, at the Nike shoe drop, at the, you know, like that sort of sponsorship side of thing is just like cool with everybody, and that's where they.
Yeah, like it's almost like when people stop buying records, everyone's like, the rule book's out the window now.
Yeah.
So it's, we can do whatever we want.
Yeah. But to see that, like, the priority among these people is to, like, get in the van, drive across Mississippi, play to the weirdo kids there, sleep on someone's, like, dog bed.
Yeah.
You know, and then, like, get up and punk it out and get to the next place in, like, Birmingham, Alabama, that it was great and so, you know, inspiring, exciting. So when we went up the East Coast, I took them to go visit the Discord House and to go see Ian and show them like where I used to crack and like, you know, take them down in the basement where all those songs got recorded and written and demoed out. And it was like this great experience of like showing him like, this is, you know, I'm sure he knows it's still active in all these forms, but like, this is, you know, it's still a continuum and like the ethics are still being played out. And
there's like this story someone told me where, it's like Born Against, you know, that mm-hmm, made, like yeah. playing this show in DC. And I think, I forget which member's like reading a zine at the table, and there's this guy who comes to the merch table like, "Yeah, I'd like to buy a record and shirt." And he's like, "Don't like look it up." And he's like, "You know, this stuff keeps me going." And he looks up at Zine McKay, yeah. and it's just like, that's like I think everyone's fantasy. Yeah. in DC.
So I don't know. It was great, and you know, and it, you see Ian, and it's like he is talking to Pujol because he's yeah. been a pen pal of Daniel from Pujol since he was a teenager, and like there are these like active veins of yeah. like ongoing. Genuine culture being built and networks being maintained that are important to me and significant.
Well, I guess we can kind of leave it there and like yeah. and stuff like that. That's thank you so much for coming in. This was awesome. And boom, high five.
Thank you, Lance. And as mentioned before, Lance will be back for a part two and an update because that was a long ass time ago. You know, Lance has done Flophouse since then. So there's like, you know, he's been busy. And so there's like a lot to catch up on. So thank you very much for joining us for the lost episode of Turned Out of Punk. Because next week on the show, we are at episode 100. And so I wanted to do something kind of different for episode 100. I thought, like, you know, what would be something that would be worth doing? And a lot of people that I... not a lot of people that I hit up. A lot of people have been sending in that I should have someone do a Turned Out of Punk episode with me. And I don't have a lot of interest in doing that, unfortunately. Or fortunately. But I did think it would be kind of cool to do a kind of roundabout way of doing it, which is I decided next week on the show I'm doing a Turned Out of Punk with my mom and dad. Separately, they're divorced. And so they will have their own episodes. And yeah, I'm going to pop the same question I popped to everyone. How did you get into punk? And believe me, we've got a lot more planned for the next 100. I've got a run for the first five after episode 100 that are, there's some pretty awesome stuff coming up in that one too. So this show keeps going, you know, from strength to strength as far as my enjoyment of it. And I really appreciate all of you for supporting it as much as you have. And thank you for telling your friends about it. I'm going to be doing all this again next week, but I decided why not do it twice because, god damn it, that's what I do on this thing. I promise also next week I'm not going to be in a hotel room or flying on caffeine, so we'll be back to normal. This has been a special episode. This is like the lost episode, like that Mr. Show sketch, you know, or that old Mr. Show episode, the lost episode. Anyway, good night, you crazy kids. Go out there and make your own culture because anyone can do this shit and... come back next week for episode 100. Subscribe to this. Tell your friends. See you next week. Thank you very much. Bye.